The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Our guest, Dennis E. Tenen, began his career as a Microsoft engineer in the Windows Group, where he wrote code that runs on computers around the world. He later joined academia and is currently an associate professor of English at Columbia University, where he also serves as co-director of the Center for Comparative Media. Affiliated with Columbia's Data Science Institute, he is a former fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and the author of two earlier works on the intersection of writing and computing. In his new book, Literary Theory for Robots, Yi Tenen takes readers on a century-spanning trip through automation to explore the relationship between writers and emerging technologies. A reviewer in the New York Times describes the book as surprisingly funny and resolutely unintimidating. Yi Tenen has figured out how to present a web of complex ideas on a human scale. Please welcome our guest to the Free Library.
All right, well, thank you for this introduction, and thank you for having me here. Let me fix this mic. So again, I'm so happy to be here in this amazing institution, and also it's kind of two incredible institutions coming together, because it's the Free Library here in Philadelphia, and also the W.W. Norton Press, which is an independent press, and it's an employee-owned publisher, and that's like a long-standing American institution. So I'm really happy to also, and thank you to everybody at Norton who made this book possible. So okay, now let me tell you a little bit of the story of how I came to write this book, and maybe give you a glimpse of the kind of materials that find their way into the book. Okay, so. Like many of you, a few years ago, I started noticing that my email client was completing my sentences pretty well, and I was going like, where did that come from? And of course, when GPT and other chatbots large language models came around and became kind of a part of the news cycle, I, as a historian of literature, as a historian of text, and as a historian of digital text, I was really interested about the precursors of this contemporary moment that always seems to us so unique and special and extraordinary. So that's the, in my mind, what you see on the slide here is kind of the picture that was in my mind. I was like, okay, we have these GPTs, they're neural networks, and they seemed pretty complicated, but my question was, what came before? And I started trying to fill out this timeline as a historian going backwards, okay? Now, there are a few academic, let's see, I might just skip, no, okay. Now, I'll tell you, I have so many anecdotes, so I'll tell you this one. So, one of the precursors that I found that goes all the way to 1895 was this little-known author named George Polti, and he was a French author, and he wrote a book called The 36 Dramatic Situations in 1895, and it was translated into English in 1916. Now, Polti is hilarious. Polti, French playwright, not really famous during his time, but he was like a good businessman and very entrepreneurial. And so he writes this book and he says, look, all of the world literature can be reduced to 36 dramatic situations. And these 36 dramatic situations, when combined algorithmically, though he didn't use this word, but when combined using certain rules in various configurations, can produce amazing literature for you. And then he says, you know, if you send me $5, here's my address. Like, that's actually how his book ends. Send me $5, and I'll send you 10,000 plays right away, and then you can, you know, submit them to a publisher and make some money. So when I found this author, you know, he, again, I've never heard of him. He's not evidenced at all in literary history. You know, he's hardly mentioned. But his book, this particular book, was all over advertisements in journals that were coming into prominence at the end of the 19th century, okay? Now, the end of the 19th century, let me read something from my book, maybe just a paragraph. Think about what you know already about the end of 19th century, not about literature. So think about, like, you know, Victorian England, I don't know, and also, I mean, it's the industrial age, right? So if you were a cobbler in the 19th century, probably something happened to your job, right? Like, basically, you were making shoes by hand in a little workshop, and then along came a factory that made shoes, and all of a sudden, you went from making one pair of shoes per month or whatever it is, to making many shoes at the same time. And what we see in the 19th century in the history of manufacturing is an incredible increase in productivity, right? Like that's the basic story we know about the industrial manufacturing in the 19th century. But we don't often think about the same story happening in the life of the mind, and we don't think of the same story happening for knowledge workers or creative workers. But let me give you some numbers. Authors prolific by 19th century standards wrote an order of a dozen or so novels, okay? But so somebody like Dickens and Dostoevsky, and you know, Dickens and Dostoevsky really prolific by their time. You know, everybody called them prolific, it's not just me. So by their standards, they were super prolific. And both of them wrote for periodicals. They wrote for journals where pieces of their novels appeared, you know, month in, month out. So both of them penned fewer than 20 novels each. So 20 novels in a career was considered a lot. Now, Tolstoy, slightly even more productive. The Soviets published Tolstoy's collected works in 90 volumes, so this is a little bit of an outlier, though a lot of it was like letters and he wrote essays and stuff like that. Dumas is a very, you know Dumas, Three Musketeers? Very interesting person, one of the first authors to use like a ghostwriting farm. He used ghostwriters to actually produce novels. Also another very good writer businessman. But by the first half of the 20th century, so I'm talking about 1910s, 1920s, such exceptional output became the norm. George Simenon, the Belgian writer of detective fiction, published several hundred novels, 75 of them about the French police detective Jules Maigret. Elizabeth Mead Smith, the author of A World of Girls, highly recommended, wrote more than 300 mysteries, romance novels, and works of young adult fiction. Paul Little, more than 700 novels. Kathleen Lindsay, Mary Faulkner, more than 900. Edward Stratemeyer, the American author, producer behind the writer syndicates responsible for such popular series as The Rover Boys and Nancy Drew, wrote thousands in their career. The Spanish author of romance novels, Corin Tellado, wrote more than 4,000 novels. So something happens where in the 19th century, we go from having 20 novels, being pretty prolific, to writing hundreds, if not thousands, of novels, being kind of the norm. And so you see this incredible, just if you just look at basic statistics of average number of books published for an author and the kind of volume that publishers were getting in terms of manuscripts, it increases tenfold and sometimes a hundredfold. And now, I kind of already gave you a little bit of the punchline. If you were not surprised about the shoemaker making many more shoes at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, if you're not surprised by, you know, Fordism and Taylorism and kind of all sorts of production moving to industrial scale, it also should not surprise you that being a creative type, being an artist, being an author at the end of the 19th century involved more industrial tools. And so partly how I began thinking about this book is not so much just history of chatbots and history of technology and history of computers, but really a history of labor. If you think of authors as a kind of a labor class, then again, they begin to follow the trajectory that we know so well in the labor across all other realms. So the kind of disruptions and the kind of pressures that were put upon factory workers in the end of the 19th century also happen in the creative sphere. It's just this type of history is not very well documented and it's not very well written about. And so here I was beginning to find this George Polti guy who wrote, you know, the 36 dramatic situations and who suggests that authors begin to ramp up their production in by using his system. Now, at first, when I found him, he seemed to be an outlier. I thought, well, here's a weirdo. Nobody knows about this French guy. He himself says, like, other people hate me. They call me the assassin of wonder. So he says, like, people will absolutely hate what I'm doing because I'm, like, puncturing this bubble of, you know, the mystical genius author, and I'm telling you to go and write according to the numbers, write by the numbers, write by the system. And I saw also that though the book was written in 1895, it was translated in 1916 into English, and it was sold widely in the early 20th century by, you can see already here, by the editor company and by people like James Knapp Reeve in 1921. So this is what a little bit of, I'm giving you like archival detective trace. So I'm like, okay, wait a second. This marginal guy doesn't seem to be so marginal. His work is being advertised all over various journals in the United States. Okay, 10 minutes. I'm going to skip the actual content. Now, where was Polti's work advertised? Well, look at this. 1896, the Editor Journal of Information for Literary Workers. And I love all of these words. Journal, information, and literary workers. It's exactly kind of, I mean, you know, it's exactly the kind of argument I wanted to make, is that writers are literary workers. That's a great way of putting it, actually. And then you'll see that the editor, this particular journal, was actually founded by James Knapp Reeve, the very same publisher behind the translation of Polti into English. And on the pages of the editor, you see advertisements for the 36 dramatic situations. You see it there. But also look at the other books available there. The writer's book, the most practical book for writers ever published. Technique of Fiction Writing, How to Write a Short Story. Point is, there were just hundreds and hundreds of these systems and of these books targeted to professional authors, and they were all about how to increase your productivity, how to write more, how to submit more manuscripts. And with this, you know, that's what created a sense of my archive and a sense of the kind of books that ended up making it into this story. All right, so now, a little bit, this prehistory began to fill up. The writer, 1887. The editor, 1895. The author, 1889. You see, this is when the journals are being founded. So in particular, you see, it's a particular moment where many of these are being founded. Writer's Review, 1925. Writer's Monthly, 1925. Author's Digest, 1927. Markets and Methods for Writers, Author and Journalist, 1887. And so on. Okay, you saw this. Now, alongside the periodicals, the journals, you also have a flourishing of books that are kind of extensions of this, of Polti's, similar to Polti's book. William Price wrote in 1992, The Technique of Drama. So note this word technique. It's you know, technical. It's technique. It's how to write, almost like a formulaic, an attempt to derive a formula for the writing of drama. 1908, The Technique of the Novel. Again, this word, technique. They really love this word in the early 20th century. Now, Plato, William Cook, Plato, A New Method of Plot Suggestion for Writers of Creative Fiction, 1928. These books are really hard to find, some of them, by the way. And I have for you a few. I had to hunt them down, so maybe afterwards I can show them to you. But here's Plato, A Master Book of All Plots. And what it is, it's a number. You can, when you come up, you'll see that much better. But they're little snippets that are, you know, let's see, let me read one. Okay, A receives a blow on the head, which causes him to lose his original personality and return to a fictitious personality, which he had previously assumed. And so that's number 1390, 1390. And then from there, I can go to 1124 or 1128. And by following a path, kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure through this book, I would produce a skeleton of a racy, pulpy story about murder and about fictitious personalities and so on. Blows to the head. And like I said, just like there were dozens of journals in this genre, there were hundreds of books in this genre that were presenting systems, formulaic systems, technique systems for authors to accelerate their writing. And part of the punchline in this book, and it's a particular snapshot that I'm zooming in, the book covers several more centuries, but here is a particular important moment where you can see that that increase in productivity that we can witness in the publishing history, we can explain it in part by these tools that emerge, by these technical, algorithmic, combinatorial tools used to accelerate composition. The writers using these tools were publishing pulp fiction. They were publishing radio plays. This is a big time. They were also publishing on Broadway, and this was playwrights used these tools. And of course, the beginning of Hollywood. You writers could start to begin to sell their scripts to Hollywood. And that was also another major kind of income stream for authors. Let's see, how much time do we have? 15 minutes. Okay, I have, like I said, many fun stories in this book. Here's a really entertaining story. George Baker was a Harvard professor and the founder of the theater program at Harvard in 1919. And when he begins to teach at Harvard, he assigns a book by William T. Price, who calls himself the Aristotle from Kentucky. So William T. Price, the Aristotle from Kentucky, writes a book called The Technique of Drama. Just like you see, you kind of get the genre here. They're all kind of technique of something. And so Baker from Harvard assigns Price's book in 1892 and teaches Harvard students to produce Broadway plays, and they actually become quite successful, and there are several major plays that appeared on Broadway from that class. But then by 1919, Baker says, what the heck, why don't I just write my own version of it? And he basically rewrites it and calls his book The Dramatic Technique instead of The Technique of Drama, and then begins to assign his own version of this. And obviously, like, Baker is the one that everybody knows about as this one of, like, father figures of drama studies in the United States, and the Aristotle from Kentucky nobody has ever heard of. So you can see this movement, the movement from the professional author's market up to places like Harvard, and not the other way around, the way maybe literary historians would like to think about this. Now, around these kind of materials, you see also all sorts of other devices. This, for example, is Robo, the game that writes a million story plots. This is 1928 by Wycliffe Hill. And so you can see you can spin a circle, and you get a little bit of a random number generation. Then you have your hero, place, climax, heroine, and so on, obstacle, and then you have a form that you fill out, and you get a little skeleton story. Similarly, you have the plot genie. This is the plot robot. There's a circle right here. And I have a little surprise for you as well. I've managed to actually find one of these, also very rare, with the insert. So you can see there's a circle that you spin. It generates a number. And then it's another system. It's another one of these combinatorial systems where by going through the book, you can generate a comedy or a romance novel or a murder mystery and so on. Here's another artifact for you, 1916. This is a movie writer patented by Blanchard, by somebody named Blanchard. And what you can see here is a device with little knobs that you rotate on the left. And each of these knobs contains a scroll. So you can see on the bottom left, the scroll has many options. And so by rotating them randomly, what you get is a skeleton plot. Once again, in this particular case, aged, aviator, bribes, a cannibal, then carousal ensues, and then there's the escape. So here's an automatic robot movie writer from 1928. Like I said to you, these are, I'm just giving you a glimpse into the archive. It's an incredible archive. You can think of this as the writer's workshop and the various tools, the various early, late 19th century, early 20th century automated tools that could be found in many authors' workshops. And they were in use, and they were, like I said, evidenced all over this particular archive. I could go on. I mean, you know, I became kind of a nerd of this sort of materials. Another type of device you would find very often is a filing system. People were really excited about filing systems. So think about, in a contemporary sense, a large language model or a database. That's what we would say today. But back then, they would say a filing system. And the filing systems were used to systematically collect realistic detail that you could later use to flesh out your skeleton plots. So for example, you're a writer, you're sitting in the bar, somebody's saying something weird, you're gonna write this down, you're gonna file it in your system. And once you have hundreds or thousands of such notes, you can then sort of, you're writing a story about a crazy sailor, you look into your file under sailor or whatever, and then you're like, oh, how does sailors talk? And so you're using a database, and you're using, and, you know, in the journals, they get nerdy about it. They're like, okay, sailor, you can cross-file it under S, and also under profession, and also under C. You know, and they're like thinking about actually how, if you begin to systematically collect and archive your materials, snippets from newspapers, various kind of found material that you have, if you have a large archive, how do you efficiently, you know, then access it? So these are the kind of, if you are writing using databases today, you sort of are doing a similar kind of a thing, only on a more industrial scale. Now, let me conclude. Let me just connect a few dots. We don't have time to connect all the dots. So, if we advance just a few decades, in the late 1950s, 1960s, MIT, Harvard, and other places get their first computers, get their first digital computers where they can experiment with them. And that first generation of computer scientists, one of the things, the first thing they do is missile trajectories. Okay, we'll talk about that later. But the second thing they do is to start generating stories and start generating English sentences. And when they begin to generate English sentences, what they do is they look backwards and they see who else before us, who came up with a systematic way to compose stories. And some of the first algorithmic, computerized, digital story generators take the very materials you saw before that were appearing in print, and they were kind of paper and ink systems, and they replicate them in computer forms. So some of the first generation artificial intelligent language generators in the early 1960s, they take the paper and ink systems that you saw here and kind of make them digital, make them faster, make them, you know, with larger databases, more combinatorial algorithmic power, and so on. And so this archive that I showed you that was found in the writer's workshop flows directly into the first generation of AI research in places like MIT, Wisconsin, and Stanford, and so on. And so those are the kind of stories, you know, I zoomed in on early 20th century for you and late 19th century, but there, you know, we can go forward into actual computer age that leads us to the GPT moment through many, you know, many alleys and diverging paths that you can read about in the book, and going back all the way back to medieval times where you see similar devices like the circles you saw with a roboplotter, combinatorial divination circles used in the Arabic tradition, used in Spain, in medieval Spain, and used across the world to talk to God and to predict weather and to do horoscopes, but also it's ways in which humans have been talking with machines and creating texts with machines for a very long time. And I think that helps explain some of the contemporary moment as well. looking at the history of this machine, I think it tells us something about the present time, but it also, I think it gives me hope, at least, that, you know, though the moment seems exceptional, we have always been creating, creating poetry and creating music and creating theater with the aid of algorithms. And you can find more in my book. Okay, thank you. I'll stop there. And maybe, what are we doing? We're taking questions, right, for 20 minutes? Okay, great. I would love to, I'd love to hear from you and take your questions.
I'm curious about quality. Obviously, like, these systems generate a large quantity, but most of the authors, I'm assuming, that use these systems were relatively forgettable. Can you talk a little bit about how they've tried to improve the quality of what you get from this?
Yeah, so, I mean, definitely, like, people like Polti, he thought that the quality would improve. I mean, basically, you can take a very crappy writer and make him into a mediocre writer. So there's, you know, there's definitely this sort of, I mean, there is a democratic, let's say, spirit in this material where they thought they're making authorship available to a greater number of people. So that's, on the one hand, it's, you can think of it like rising tide lifts all boats, but it's not going to make you into, like, you know, a Dickens. So that's one. But the second thing I want to tell you about in this question. So when, you know, I went to school for studying literature, and for example, we were told that James Joyce and Nabokov, the geniuses that they were, the unique geniuses that they were, they used index cards to compose really complicated literary works. So part of what they invented, I was told, right, is that writing on index cards and then being able to shuffle index cards. And it was presented as if, like, this cool, modernist, high art sort of practice. But then when I discovered this archive, I saw that on the pages of, like, the student writer, in a way earlier, like 50 years before Nabokov, you have advice for young authors that says, hey, write your paragraphs on index cards and shuffle them around. And right, so basically, some of these techniques do pass from just, like, everyday, you know, like your average writer, to later on to actually some writers like Nabokov, who uses some of these techniques, maybe not to write more, but to write kind of more innovative and kind of more interesting novels as well.
I also had a question about quality because, yeah, I was kind of like, yeah, but how good are these, right? But I was wondering if you, and I know this is kind of a difficult question to make. So in some ways, I'm kind of, I like the argument, right? That, yeah, like, we've always been using these algorithms and it's not new. But in other ways, when you use ChatGPT, it does feel new, right? Yeah. So, like, you could spin for a plot, but you still had to do, like, a lot of the story and the kind of conversational nature, even though, like, it's not really a conversation, it does feel remarkably similar. Mm. And we know, in fact, that, like, before people are told that it's an AI, they've done studies, for example, with, like, feedback to students. Students prefer feedback from AI. So kind of, what do you see as, or do you see anything as really moving beyond this, like, just algorithmic legacy?
Yeah. No. So I agree with you. And I think, but I want to kind of have it both ways. So on the one hand, so when I read, the book begins with the 14th century Arabic philosopher. His name is Ibn Khaldun. And Khaldun, he encounters one of these systems, which is a rotating, it's like circles within circles, and you rotate them in the 14th century. And then he follows, like, it's a complete algorithm. He says, like, spin it 7 times, you know, spin around, do some magical stuff. And then the thing actually spits out verse from the Quran, and it's rhymed. And so he's floored, and you he's writing down, like, how he's using it. He's completely floored, and he's like, this is either, like, a magic trick, or this thing is actually communicating with God. So the fact that you use a machine and it feels, like, super advanced, so imagine, like, that's the 14th century version of, like, ChatGPT, and people are floored. People are going, like, well, this is going to completely change everything. Oh, my God, this thing may be divine, and it's going to kill us all, or it's going to save us all, whatever it is. So I do want to say that the exceptional moment is not as exceptional in history. But I think also you're right, is that the fact is that ChatGPT is is much more available to us than these kind of tools. And in medieval times, only like a few marginal weirdos were spinning the circles and doing in a way that ChatGPT today is available to every student. So both the accessibility and the sheer volume of algorithmically produced text, I do think that's different, right? That's a different dynamic. The final thing I want to say is that and this is how I end the book, really, is to say there's like this paradoxical thing that happens, is that technology, what it does is, for a moment, all technology seems miraculous and exceptional, right? So whatever, try to remember when like Google came out or when Wikipedia came out, or like every turn of the screw seems incredible. But then when it begins to be the kind of, when it diffuses through culture and when everybody uses it, it all of a sudden becomes average. And then everybody can, like, basically everybody can write like a decent email today and that's the rising tide lifting old boats. So what counts as average performance of intelligence is now higher. And it's constantly going higher, aided by tools. Like, our cognitive capacity have not changed in, you know, 200 or 300 years. Our biology is the same. But today, you're able to access information and think, like, basically, you know, the stuff you can access just online quickly is the equivalent of being, like, the smartest person ever in the 19th century. But it's also now average. That capacity is average, and humans constantly effervesce. We like bubble up, and we become more than average. So the tide lifts, and then we find ways to be exceptional above that. So it's a constant sort of race of like humans and the what's available to the average person. But, you know, I'm not as bothered by the fact that it's great that we're all like, I want to receive better emails. You know, I want to receive better essays and by like whatever means necessary. So I'm not against this. There's something democratizing in these tools that I actually appreciate. And it's very clear, especially in that 19th century kind of workers' moment, like workers' power moment, where people like Price, the Kentucky Aristotle, they're super anti-genius. They're like, these people think that they're the only brilliant ones, but like, here's the way, like, I'm going to teach you how to do this. Like, everybody will be able how to do it. And they want to sort of make exceptional the norm.
Thank you so much. This is going to be hard to articulate. I just have like a lot of notes here. I'm concerned about, so I didn't come here with like the technology background so much. I was wondering what is going to be the intersection between AI and narratology. The narratology is what got me. I was thinking about Vladimir Prop and the Russian formalists and fairy tales. So when you started showing that, I'm thinking, oh, yay, like this is the algorithm that I recognize from my own literary theory study.
Right.
Okay, so that as a background, I'm fast forwarding now to teaching and pedagogy in general. And you know, as a university professor and as a writer, how many teachers are in a quandary about how to teach writing in the face of a technology like this, and how many students are becoming dependent on a technology like this without developing their own authentic voice, really having a sense of who their audience is, let alone, I mean, the teaching of writing has changed so much, and actually this is the focus of my action research, and now I'm winding towards my question.
Sure, sure.
So many don't feel a facility towards teaching of writing. So how can we incorporate this tool as one of many? What suggestions do you have for us as teachers or for people who don't identify as a writer? I do, but most of my colleagues do not. And this has been the focus of my research. They haven't been taught how to write, or they, you know, they're not sure what is good writing. And because writing is a practice, it's a product, but it's also a process. So how does technology intersect with this, and where do we see this landing for pedagogy?
Yeah. Thank you. It's a great question, and also you can tell it's like on the mind of every educator in the world right now. So that's it's great that you're giving voice to that. But here's the deal: is that I'm trying to change the kind of our perspective a little bit, and to say that, you know, I don't even like to say like artificial intelligence to me is like a misnomer, because artificial intelligence implies that there's some pure biological intelligence that we have that somehow exists like outside of technology and outside of culture and outside of like working with other people. Whereas when I try to think about like to what extent when I write, I'm completely surrounded by tools. I'm like a dictionary, a thesaurus is a tool. And it took us like centuries to create a good thesaurus in English, right? And that the amount of labor that went into the creation of a thesaurus is intense. It's, you know, hundreds, thousands of people who contributed to a thesaurus, which then helps me find a better word. And that word is not in my mind. That word is on my bookshelf. And it's thanks to this collaboration over centuries with this amazing like lexicographers that made me slightly a better writer, right? So once we start thinking that all intellect is already kind of surrounded by technique and artifice and device and really by collaboration, that this notion of a genius alone author, biological singular author, is not really how writing works. And primarily writing and creativity happens in groups and it's mediated by technology. I think then we can start thinking, okay, how do we write in groups better? How do we sort of build a practice of writing that actually does, like kind of does well by that model? So just like intellect is, because all intellect is already artificial and already has artifice in it, you can think of it in another way to put it is intellect is already manufactured. It's always manufactured. And I'll tell you an anecdote. Well, last year I was in Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia, and I was giving this talk. I was just finishing this book, and I was giving exactly this talk in Kyrgyzstan. And I, as you can imagine, I got exactly the same question from the faculty. The faculty are like, oh my God, they're going to like submit all their papers on ChatGPT. But then the student, one of the local students, got up and she said, other students here in Kyrgyzstan, if they're wealthy, they just purchase all their papers. Like, you just go to the library and there are just like ads everywhere, like, we'll write your paper. So the fact that like intelligence is manufactured and it can be bought, you know, that the intelligence is already in the marketplace, like, you don't need technology for that. You can just hire other people. And in fact, that's what happens in most of the world. When you manufacture intellect, you can just purchase it. You can get a bunch of people to follow you around and help you out with these tasks. And this student said, For me, the fact that now there is this ChatGPT thing that's kind of free, it's actually like an equalizer. Before, I couldn't afford to hire a ghostwriter like my wealthy colleagues, and I couldn't afford to buy a dissertation. But now I can sort of have this like Silicon Valley team of shadowy collaborators, sort of, and they felt like that equalizes their playing field. So, again, once you switch the perspective and once you understand that already we are in this world where intellect is performed, manufactured, where, you know, it's subject to technique and artifice, I think then we can think of ways of writing and writing practices that don't pretend that it's not, that don't pretend that, you know, writing happens by singular geniuses in solitary confinement. Most writing happens in teams. Even when you're writing alone, you're reaching for textbooks, you're reaching for thesaurus, you're reaching for dictionaries. And I think the ChatGPT moment forces us to like rethink what writing is and kind of rethink of what the writing practice is and think of different writing assignments that I think are more ambitious. It opens up like new forms and new, you know. So I'm doing, in my classes, I'm doing much more writing in teams. Like I said, it's just like, let's make it obvious. Let's stop pretending that everybody, you know, like, oh my God, you know, like the worst thing is plagiarism and like, do not copy anybody. Whereas like, I'm sitting there going like, I'm going to try to write like Nabokov, or I'm going to try to write like, you know, I'm constantly copying people, but then I'm pretending that that's not what's happening in the classroom. So that's, you know, I know it's not exactly the, you know, it's not a singular answer, but this change of perspective, I think, is very helpful in imagining new practices of writing for students.
So I was thinking about what you talked about earlier of giving the analogy of the cobbler. So in addition to the change in scale, there was also a devaluation of that labor.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
The value of shoes went down, yeah. And you know, that has led to mass consumerism. But yeah. What do you think the pathway looks like if Now, anyone can write a book in like 30 seconds by asking ChatGPT to write one for you. What does the devaluation of writing look like, and what's next? Yeah.
Well, so I'm just guessing that, as you know, so the story of a cobbler is not a happy one, as you know. And so point is that labor is tremendously disturbed by automation. So that's just a fact. And it's just, it came to the writer and the legal profession and the medical profession and the professor later, you know, like a century later. So one is we can draw some, you know, we know what happened to other professions and we can sort of think of, and you know, I don't have an easy fix for you because it's not like we figured that out in any other field. You know, labor is a struggle in everywhere really, but in this particular political and economic climate, it's a struggle. But once we see creative labor as labor, which I think is important, I think it becomes obvious. I mean, the writers' strikes in Hollywood make it, like, they remind us that, look, these shows do not write themselves. Consider us a part of the labor force and treat us equally, treat us fairly. So once you start kind of viewing authorship and all other modes of creative labor as labor, we can start imagining how to address those kind of disruptive forces brought to automation. I have more to say. Let me just say shortly that partly, you know, part of that automation and part of that viewing myself as a worker who works on a computer and who works with text. So, for example, using open source tools, not writing in Microsoft Word, but writing using open tools like Free Office and Open Office. I think that's the kind of small steps we can take to kind of make sure that the tools that are part of this automation technology paradigm, they remain in the public domain. I think the problem, you know, if ChatGPT is only the domain of like large international corporations, I think that's a problem for the creativity, you know, capacity for creativity in the world. But if those tools can be open, if they can be truly accessible, if we can play with them, if we can mess with them and kind of reshape them and customize them for our own needs, if we can have a say in the tools of our production, I think that's a slightly better future than the one that we saw with the cobbler.
First of all, thank you very much for this. This was really interesting. So I guess, first of all, one of the reasons everybody's so thrown off by the GPTs is that, first of all, the speed with which it came out, but also what it can do. So I'm thinking about, like, on the technical side, which is kind of where my domain is. So, you know, we had an abacus, then we had a calculator, we had a computer. And so those were all great tools. And so you, the tools that you were talking about, all those great algorithms, and they helped you to write prose. Mm. But now you have the prose written for you, or at least a starting point.
Mm.
How does that change attribution for, if I'm going to start a story and I'm going to have GPT write the beginning of it for me? It's not an outline that it gives me. It actually gives me the story. How would I attribute that?
Right. So, I mean, the quick answer is I don't know. But the long answer, so again, let me try to at least the beginnings of a shifting perspective. So instead of saying artificial intelligence, what I propose is we say collective intelligence. And I believe that most intelligence is collective intelligence. The majority of things that I know, like, I'm not that smart. I don't know anything. Like, where the moon is, how far away, stuff. Like I don't know. But I know where to look it up, right? So point is, like, our knowledge truly is, like, our, what should we call it? Like, the monument of human creativity and knowledge. Like, it's the cloud of sort of everything that we ever wrote and produced and figured out, science and art and the humanity. Like, that's really cool, and it's so much bigger than us. So once we think of intelligence as collective intelligence, then these tools, I think we can see these tools in a different light. So for example, for ChatGPT to work, what it's doing is drawing on everything that was written online. So it's doing something similar to what I would do when I write, is I consult a bunch of stuff that was already written, and I emulate certain passages, I look up information. The mistake was to think that my authorship was somehow so individual and I was like this lone genius that didn't need any help. But if you start with the point of view that most intelligence is already collective, the fact that there is like a slightly more mechanized, you know, like a little mechanized shovel that shovels that information for you and reaches inside this great collective archive, that piece of technology is built on centuries of writing, centuries of, like, that's the training data. But why should we discount? Like, when I look at ChatGPT, I'm not just kind of amazed by the fact that it's a cool, like, piece of recent tech. I'm amazed that it's drawing on those centuries. Without it, without that archive, without that legacy, without that tradition, it's not very smart. It's only smart by the fact that it's, you know, you can think of it like, is the search engine smart? Like when you see, you know, before ChatGPT, like search engine is amazing. The fact that you can reach out into this archive and pull out amazing stuff. So it's just, it's doing that, but faster. And, you know, on a greater scale, and the scale does matter. So that's my kind of long-winded answer, is that if you start from collective intelligence, ChatGPT seems like the continuation of that. If you start with, before ChatGPT, I was writing everything by myself, but now it's writing for me, the gap seems huge. But from the collective intelligence perspective, the gap is, you know, it's just another, you know, it's another furtherance of the same. And look, we know historically what happens to technology. Are you right now so amazed by search engine? Like when the search engine, you know, we're old enough to know, when the search engine came out, everybody was floored. It was amazing. And also people said it's going to change everything. And it did change a lot of things. But also now people are like, yeah, whatever. Like, you know, nobody's, and, you know, ChatGPT, I mean, that we know for sure that's every new technology seems miraculous for that moment. And then, and because it's being dissolved into the common, because it's being devalued, it then becomes completely ordinary. And then there'll be extraordinary people that will do something really cool with ChatGPT or whatever. Like that, I'm not worried about like humans actually rising above that average, because we have always done that through every turn of the screw, every next generation of artificially intelligent tools. We incorporated them into our practice and rose above. So I you know, that's kind of the general approach.
I had a follow-up to the kind of education and attribution question. And I had a question about where in your framework, or if you include the idea of writing as thinking. And I'm kind of having a debate in my head, because on the one hand, like, I write, so I think I privilege it as like this special, you know, thing. And I, in some ways, it is like being a cobbler, right? But we also know that, like the act of composing, even if it's the most banal undergrad paper, changes how we understand information. So yeah, all of the information is out there and it is collective, but kind of the process of me putting it together in my head neurologically, right? Mm. Kind of changes my schema for that, right? And so similarly, we use thesauruses as adults, but conceptually we were taught what a synonym is. And so I guess I'm wondering kind of how that fits into the framework you're thinking about.
Yeah, no, that's it's this question I struggle with all the time. So to what extent this AI, because, you know, there is something about writing. It's like ChatGPT was more shocking to people than other advances in like robotics and AI that are not, you know, they're just not as accessible or, you know, whatever. And there are many kind of artificially smart systems. Like my example is always like the automatic transmission in your car. Like that's a smart system. Before you had to do the gears, and now it like decides you're going up the hill and it does some, you know, and like that's a kind of little AI that does stuff for you, but then we completely, you know, they disappear from you. So is there something special about language that's connected to thought? So that's like a huge philosophical question, you know, so I don't have an easy answer for you, but here's the interesting part is that when I looked in the materials I found, so for example, when you read Turing, in his really influential paper on computable numbers, where he imagines the Turing machine, the blueprint of contemporary computation. Or when you read Babbage and Ada Lovelace, who have like the previous iteration of, you know, the Babbage machine, and it's the universal Babbage machine, they're constantly conflating language with thinking for whatever reason. When you look at the first AI generation, the generation of Chomsky and his lab at MIT, who created the first English sentence language generator, they're constantly conflating writing with thinking. Whereas it's so, and I read it, and I'm like, why? That's, I mean, that's part of thinking, and writing is a cognitive activity, but it's not the only cognitive activity. There's plenty of people who don't write at all, and they're really smart, and they do other. So, and to what extent that confusion between language and thought is necessary? Like, it may be very necessary. It may be like absolutely key, and it's like a super privileged type of thinking. Or it may be just sort of like an accident of history that throughout, you know, so throughout, you know, it's a particular legacy of computing that always wanted, like, think about all the metaphors around computing. Like, computer has memory, and it reads and write. Like, reading and writing is like the most basic, that's like a technical term for what we do into memory. We read and write from memory. That's not by accident. Computing from its inception kind of purported to be a cognitive activity, and it's very connected to text and inscription and so on, and storage and retrieval. You know, it actually has to do a lot with archival, with like library science. Like, here's the we are inside of a brain, right? And we're like retrieving stuff and from shelves. And so I don't have an answer for you. I don't have like an easy answer, but I can tell you that your question is there in the arc, in the materials, in the book all the time. And it's always conflated, and it always kind of bugs me a bit. And I try to be, you know, I try to like, it always pauses me. And I also ask a similar question, but we should invite some cognitive science people to help us. Oh, that's you. So that's, you know, in philosophy of mind, I don't know. Yeah, so that's my final answer. But anyway, thank you so much. Again, thank you so much for having me here. Thank you for coming, and I hope we can keep in touch.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.